Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we begin, I'd like to open with a prayer. This is a collect for the mission of the church from the Book of Common Prayer. O God, you have made of one blood all the peoples of the earth, and sent your blessed Son to preach peace to those who are far off and to those who are near. Grant that people everywhere may seek after you and find you. Bring the nations into your fold. Pour out your Spirit upon all flesh, and hasten the coming of your kingdom through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Today, we welcome back our friend and Ciceronian Society member, Albert Norton, a practicing attorney and author of several books on the tension between religion and postmodernism. His most recent book is The Discovered Self, and it concerns what he regards as a dangerous inward turn to the therapeutic worldview, which we're going to come back to later. We previously discussed his 2023 book, The Mountain and the River, in episode 40. Welcome back, Bert.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, I wanted to start with recently you were in Europe. So just, I get your Substack, Sir Toast, as it's called. I can't remember why I think you told me why you went with that name, but I don't remember. You were just in Western Europe. What were you doing there? How was it?
We were goofing around. That's what we were doing. My wife and I have been blessed to have some opportunity just to travel in the last few years. It worked out really well. And we were actually in Switzerland back in September, October, and just a couple of weeks ago, we returned from France. So,
okay,
we've been all over. I've been posting little excerpts from the trip on the Substack that you mentioned, and just in fact put up some new pictures from the France trip just yesterday, actually.
It's such an interesting place. I haven't been to Europe. I've been there once. It was 20 years ago, actually 20 years ago this semester, essentially. And I only went to Paris, but it looked like you were going to the south of France, right? More some of the rural areas.
Yeah. On this last trip, we ended up in Bordeaux and then took some side trips from there. Went down to Bayonne. There's some small towns around Bordeaux that are interesting. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to get out of Paris.
Yeah.
And just, you know, feel a little more of the countryside. We were in Aquitaine, and I was reading this giant book on the Napoleonic Wars while we were there. So I was writing about that.
What book were you reading, if you don't mind me asking?
The Napoleonic Wars, Alexander Micah Baridze.
Is that the one that's like a global history?
Yeah,
like
it is.
Yeah.
And in fact, I learned more about the United States than
yeah.
than I ever knew before. So this is a lot of background, for example, on France versus Britain and all of the controversy there. And one of the things I learned was that dispute, an ongoing set of disputes between those countries over there, kind of allowed the United States to sort of get its footing. And of course, the Louisiana Purchase was in 1801. So this is only, you know, 12 years after the Declaration in France, and Napoleon was riding high at the time, and basically sold us a third of the continental U.S. for some money we found behind the couch cushions.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
That is a really, really good book. The Napoleonic War is a global history. I actually have read it, and I really enjoyed it. I actually read it after I read through all the Patrick O'Brien novels. The master, you might be familiar with the movie, The Master and Commander.
Yeah, sure.
Right, the whole Aubrey Matron series, which is fantastic, so good, highly recommended. And because I knew so little about the Napoleonic Wars, I'm actually surprised. I can't think of a time in my high school or even college undergraduate education where I was required to know much about it, which blows my mind. Nowadays, it's just inexcusable that I could get so far in my education and not know as much about that, because it really was a global war. It shaped so much of the world we know today, for better and worse, in some ways, for more for worse, in different ways. Go ahead.
I always had a cloud on my understanding about how we got the Oregon Territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I read an awful lot about the Oregon Trail and all that a few years ago, but I didn't appreciate that the conflicts between France and Spain, I mean France and Britain, were the reason that Britain had what was not really able to exploit its trade concessions that it had with Spain for that part of the western coast. And because of that, we could rush in there with a bunch of settlers and populate it, so that Britain's claim to it, such as it was, they just couldn't do anything with it.
Well, and it sheds a lot of, that book also sheds a lot of light on the War of 1812, which Americans in particular have overwhelmingly ignored. We don't think about it very much. The Canadians spent a lot of time on it in their education at times. But growing up in Southeast Michigan, where it was a major place for the War of 1812, especially Detroit, and all along the shores of Lake Erie on both sides, the American and Canadian side, we thought about it, but I didn't realize until I left Michigan for a time that people just did not think about the War of 1812 at all. But that was a piece, in a way, of the Napoleonic Wars, and part of that key context. In many ways, we survived that war because Napoleon, escaped Elba and came back to for the what is it, the 100 days. That's actually more than 100 days. So, anyways, we could talk about that stuff forever. I love it, and it actually gets to a little bit of what you're focusing on, which is this notion of postmodernism. Because if we want to look at a place that is beholden to postmodernism, Europe would be it, in particular. And I'm wondering, just we talked about this in the last episode with you. When you think of postmodernism, how do you define it? That's a key, very Ciceronian question. This also relates to your recent article in our journal, Pietas. How do you define postmodernism? And I'm curious if it showed up on your travels there in Western Europe.
It did show up on the travels in the sense that, in my way of thinking about it, Europe. I would place in the United States the turn towards postmodernism to be about the turn of the 20th century, and we could quibble about that all day, but just to pick a date, I would just say that in Europe it was sooner. It was an earlier date. It might have been 40, 60 years before that I would place the start date for what counts as postmodernism. And that's really the connection with Europe, in the United States. And by the way, the reason I placed the beginning of postmodernism there, it's whatever comes after modernism. So when would you say that is? You could debate that. But I say the beginning of the 20th century because I think that was kind of the tipping point for the rejection of God in the culture. And I think that is the commencement of postmodernism. And philosophically, propositionally, philosophically, what happens after about the beginning of postmodernism, it's not just, and this goes back to the Pietas article, it's not just that we reject God and then everything falls apart. It's not quite that simple. In fact, we could still have a pretty much secular society that somewhat still holds together if, okay, we've rejected God, but we still maintain some sense of moral realism in that we still accept that there's a right and wrong that's sort of written into the stars, and it universally applies, and we can hold these truths in common and thereby have some basis upon which to talk to each other about things. But if you reject not only God, but the moral realism that you could say that in the Christian understanding God sponsors, well, then you're really adrift and you're having a hard time politically and being able to come to agreement about anything. And all you got to do is pick up the paper any day and see exactly how that's working out for us.
So is postmodernism essentially just this, how do I say it, a rejection of truth in any objective sense? It's kind of just blanket relativism, subjectivism. It is the dismantling of any, as Philip Reeve would call it, like a vertical in authority in a way where we are basing truth on our own subjective experiences, power dynamics, et cetera. Is that in a very broad, vague sense. Is that what you mean by postmodern?
In the way I think of postmodernism, yes, pretty much. But when you talk about postmodernism, you have to talk about the postmodernists. And there's a bunch of them, and they have lots of different ways of looking at things. I think that relativism is necessarily a part of pretty much all of the postmodern, the secular postmodern philosophies, beginning at least as early as the 20th century. The idea behind it is that it has to be relativistic, moral relativism, and so on. It has to be that way, because what I'm saying about my big project was to find the through line for postmodern and postmodernism after reading a bunch of postmodernists. And the through line for me was that once you reject God, what the philosophers are turning to is what I call process philosophy, because you're rejecting transcendence. However you envision God or the source for truth and moral realism, however you perceive that, when you reject transcendence, what do you have left? You're trying to generate meaning and purpose out of process, and that takes different forms. But usually it's some sort of social process among the various postmodernists. That's how I was looking at the through line for postmodernism.
Yeah, I it's an interesting term to use, process philosophy. I think there is a world out there, and again, I'm not a philosopher proper, so I can't reference the other uses of that term. But it's because one of the things you bring up in the book and in your article, right, is truth, is morality simply a product of history and narrative? Is that kind of what you mean by process philosophy, where essentially there's nothing universal for the postmodern other than kind of this? I mean, in some ways, the postmodernist is always haunted by the prospect that it all doesn't mean anything. It's all just absurd and meaningless.
Right. And in fact, there's lots of people who will just say, yep, it's nihilism. It's nihilism all the way to the bottom. And that's what it is. And it's as simple as that. Yeah. But, I acknowledge that there's some process philosophies called that. I'm not really talking that. I'm just using my own sort of label for how I see it, is it's all inside the, quote, immanent frame. And to your question about, history itself, yeah, I think a key feature of postmodernism is this sort of Hegelian historicism, which is necessary to the fact that it is process philosophy. So we come to think of time itself as having the agency that we formerly ascribed to God. So there's a kind of telos in Christianity. But that's sort of out the window. And now history itself replaces God, and history itself is the generator of purpose and meaning. So you want to know what's right or wrong on a given day. Well, where are we in history? It's like when somebody gets upset, you maybe had this experience. I can't believe we're still having this discussion in 2026. What's the matter with us? What do they mean by that? They must mean that they think that we've evolved past it somehow. And that is the way you look at it if you subscribe to historicism. Whereas somebody of my disposition would look at it and go, why can't we debate it? Because there's an ultimate right or wrong about it. And let's figure out what that is. It's not that I'm trying to relitigate everything. I'm just trying to understand what's right and true in the first place.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I like about both of your books that I've read so far, is this very human struggle, right? I mean, it's someone who's honestly and humbly saying, what is the truth? What am I supposed to do? And I think that's at the heart of the life of the mind. But I'm going to say push back, but I actually don't think we disagree with each other. There's one way to look at historicism, which is kind of maybe not process philosophy, but a kind of myth of progress, right? It's the, I don't want to be part of the dustbin of history, the Hegelian Marxist view of, history is moving in a particular inexorably in this direction of justice, right? Yeah. Where all these things are going to resolve themselves. If that is the last word on historicism, I'm with you there, where essentially, you know, that because that perspective does, it closes off debate, closes off questions, and it actually just kind of steamrolls over reality, right? It's like we're going this direction whether you like it or not, and you better hop on the train, and if you don't, we're just going to run you over with it, right? That's ideology there, right? You know, that's certainly a perspective we see today. It's certainly a perspective that, in many ways, it's nihilism because it denies, it elevates the power of whoever is behind the myth of progress above and beyond. And there's nothing beyond that, right? We're moving in this direction because these people, this body of thought has decided we're going to keep moving forward. Now, there's another way to think of this, which is more, to oversimplify it, Aristotelian, where essentially there are things that are relative and subjective without doing damage to the universal truth. So the classic example, this is why I think you actually are going to agree with me on this, is of course the incarnation, right? If history and particularity is the enemy of universality and truth, then how could God become man, right? Aristotle would also put it like this, again, oversimplifying a little bit here in his critique of Plato, that Plato thought the forms, right, were more real than any instantiation of the form in this life. And so there is goodness and truth, but there are elements that are essentially relative to time and place and people, but there's also universality within that. So again, I don't want to take this too far because again, I think we could go down a rabbit hole here where if everything's relative, right, where everything is a particular of a universal, I don't think that's true. And neither did Aristotle, but there's a sense in which, could you have a historicism or a historical way of thinking that serves the universal and looks to the universal without denying differences? Does that make sense?
It does. I don't really have much to add to that. It sounds like sort of the age-old Aristotle versus Plato,
right, of course,
kind of discussion, which is why I mentioned at the beginning or just a minute ago that, of course, there's a Christian telos. There's something there, and obviously, exactly right, because of the incarnation, we are going somewhere. Mm-hmm. History does have some kind of significance, but in a Christian context, I think that's where we look for it, and it's a little bit vague and a little bit mysterious, mm-hmm. and believing Christians can have different points of view about where we're headed and where we are in on the timeline. To where we're headed, and I'm not a theologian either, so mm-hmm. I can't say more about it than that, really.
Yeah, and I another thing that I thought of while reading your book, and this is a common thing I get with students in particular, but also plenty of folks in higher education. On the one hand, you know, and I think this is even true of many Christian thinkers, they're willing to admit there's a universal truth, but they're scared to say, we need to plant our flag here. We need to say, this is true. This is beautiful. This is good. Because isn't that what totalitarian or tyrannical regimes do, right? From a political standpoint, if we go with any kind of absolutes, are we just flirting with authoritarianism, right? It's, instead of the discovered self, as your title says, are you actually advocating for, and you're not, but let's say, are you advocating for the determined self, right? This, you know, stop trying to discover yourself. Just shut up and accept this is who you are. is that kind of, you know, the alternative here, which again, I don't think that's where you're going, but how would you respond to that critique, right?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the critique because you're suggesting, well, gee, if we say there are some things that are absolutes, aren't we headed to totalitarianism? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think it's the exact opposite. I think if you reject any kind of absolutes, that's what takes you to totalitarianism, mm-hmm. both individually, subjectively, and socially. Because what is totalitarianism? It is the totality of all that we are subsumed into the state, and all authority goes upward, so to speak, in that it all control, all authority, all meaning, all direction. I mean, I go back to Mussolini's original definition of fascism. That's what I think of as kind of the model for totalitarianism, and I think that's what happens when you pull all of your what you think is meaning and truth out of the flavor of the day and social evolution.
Well, and I think there's also a sense in which, as soon as someone says this is true, they get worried that you're immediately going to impose this truth on people. But the other side of it is that no, this is the truth and the truth will set you free. Not this is the truth, shut up and accept it. It's that if you follow this truth, you will be more, what's the word here, in tune with. You'll work. You're working with reality, with the created cosmos, rather than against it, because there is something to be said about like, look, you can want this or that to be true all you want, but at the end of the day, it's not true, and if you just keep fighting reality, reality is going to win, and you might hurt a bunch of people on the way to fighting reality. I mean, that's. Again, we're heading toward this discovered self, the critique in your book. So we had this. I'm puzzled by this modern or postmodern tendency to ascribe confidence, in a way, about truth and goodness and beauty to authoritarians. Because again, just like you're saying, if we unmoor ourselves from anything solid, from anything sure, we're really it's just the will of the stronger. In that environment. And there's also, and it gets back to the whole critical theory philosophy of everything is power, essentially. Well, of course it is, if there's nothing true, if there's nothing above the powerful, right? If there's no reality beyond what we will it to be, then yeah, it's all about power. It's all about force. It's all about who wins, right? And that's a scary place to be. That's not a place of freedom and autonomy. That's a place of slavery.
It's naked power where you don't even have the pushback that would be available to say, hey, that's wrong. What about human rights? We say those are absolutes, but that's a violation of somebody's human rights. You can't go around killing people. You can't go around stuffing them into cages. You can't impose slavery because that's the flavor of the day. These are absolutely wrong, no matter what. So I don't really see a tension there between saying that they're absolutes and totalitarianism. The opposite would be true, I think.
All right, I want to move closer to your book because your book focuses on especially this emergence of what you and Philip Reeve and others refer to as the rise of therapeutic man, essentially. It is the archetype postmodern person whose soul, I mean, in the extreme version, whose sole goal is to be pleased. And by pleased or pleasured, it simply means physical pleasure. There is no there's no metaphysical at all. It's simply we just want to be happy. I just want to feel better, right? And so part of the process of self-discovery in for therapeutic man or woman in our modern age is very it's an inward turn, as you say, that is dangerous and kind of leads us to this both is fueled by and reinforces the postmodernism that we're talking about. So I guess when you say a discovered self, and I've already kind of gotten you started here. What do you mean by the discovered self, if you will?
Okay, great. All right, we talked last time about the mountain and the river. We were talking about essentially propositional philosophy and kind of what we just went over in summary fashion about what postmodernism is. I felt at the end of that there was another shoe to drop on this subject, really, and that had to do with the subjective and the psychological and the subconscious. And so, you know, that means I got to go out and read Freud, and of course, I read Reif, and I read so much, and I was pretty far into that even when that 2023 book came out. I was trying to understand. So, postmodernism we just talked about as being philosophical. So you believe in whatever society produces in a given moment as time rolls along, and you know, I can't believe you've got those outmoded beliefs. Here we are in 2026, and all that kind of thing. But so I'm trying to understand how this relates to somebody on a subjective and psychological level, because I know there's something there. And so the way I approached it was, let's start with how I think of identity. Not just how I think of identity. I've heard, let me back up. Let me take that word identity. I've heard people use the word identity to say something like, I identify as blank. Okay. So I identify as gay, or I identify as the opposite sex of what I am. And I heard that so much, and I kept thinking there's something there. They mean something by it other than just, you know, the ordinary meaning of the word identity. So what does this mean? And that's why the word is in the title of my book. Because I think the way it works is if you don't subscribe to to the therapeutic worldview, so you're not really a postmodern yourself, you're sort of reacting to postmodernism. What are you then? Well, I would say that the self that you are is you subscribe to universal values. You believe that that there's right and wrong, that's real and sort of in the cosmos, whether it's authored by God or not. And so the self, what you identify as, is something that is negotiated over time. You push against the world pushes against you. You get beat down sometimes. You have successes sometimes. And just that, and that, the sum of all that is just what you are and what you believe in. And you might also have some kind of, you know, small identities, like I'm a sports fan of this team or whatever. I went to this college. I identify as kind of belonging to those kinds of people. But that's sort of an integrated formation of self. When I say self, I mean your conception of self, how you think about yourself. And it's integrated because, it's not dependent. It's not, as I say, it's negotiated, but it's just you. It's just one layer, so to speak. It's you versus the world. Okay. And that's how your identity arrives. And then I came at this and thought, well, wait a minute. So what's different? That now we get to the discovered self, because it seems to me that when you say I identify as this or that, you are adopting something different. Now you've got the divided self happening here. So there's another self. And what is that other self? Well, it's a self I've discovered within me. I think there's something to that. One of the books I read, I think it was from back in the 60s or maybe it was 1959, something like that. It was by a guy named Lang, L.A. YNG, the psychiatrist. I think it was J.D. Lang, but I'm not positive. But he had a book called The Divided Self, and he was a Marcusean liberationist Marxist, and his psychiatry practice was emphasized existentialist point of view. And so what he said was, yeah, because there's so much oppression and repression in this authoritarian society. We have to generate this separate identity in order to get along in this society, and it's not our real identity, and we have to kind of hide our real identity and shield it with this other identity. So there's this divided self. That was kind of his theme, and I thought, well, gee, if that's the case, if you can have a divided self, then this idea that identity is another distinct self-conception is quite plausible. And in fact, if you just think about it from a common sense point of view, let's say Here we are in January. Let's say you decided you're going to go to the gym, you know, because that's your New Year's resolution. Well, there's the you that made the resolution, and then there's the you that's got to keep it, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even in that very innocuous sense, there's a divided self. You could say also there's this idea of intersubjectivity, you know, the idea that my conception of myself is that I'm not just who I think I am. Socially, I am what I think you think I am, because we're having this conversation here, and there's my sense of self right now in the course of this conversation is distinct from my conception of self 5 minutes before we started. So there are distinct conceptions of self. So once you adopt the therapeutic worldview, and I haven't really defined that yet, but let's just say we're in it. That is so thoroughgoing that you look inward for guidance on everything, and you trust your feelings about everything. Because of that, you can have this separate conception of self, and you discover it. And in fact, in my book, I go further than that and say, not only do you discover this this inner self that's distinct from, you know, what you were before you conceived of it, but that inner self, and I'm going to use the word Gnosticism, because this is sort of a, I mean, it's a Gnosticism, probably the best explanation for this. You are that inner being, that inner self, that inner identity that you are now, you have now discovered. Where does that identity come from? I think it has an esoteric source, and I don't mean something spiritual like in the, you know, the Gnostics of yesteryear. I mean it's actually social messaging. It's sort of I'm gonna pull out of the zeitgeist whatever's the latest thing, and that's going to go to form my identity. And I think that's true because it goes a long way towards explaining the social contagion of all these psychological maladies that people go through. Because there isn't another explanation for it. I think it's from the discovered self.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I want to kind of unpack a little bit of what you said, because it makes me think of Rousseau, makes me think, great, because his concept of nature, kind of understanding like who I really am is this nature unfettered from science, technology, tradition, et cetera. Same thing with critical theory, right? The whole idea is you reject tradition because you want to be autonomous in the fullest sense, which is that all the, like you said, well, history just beats you down. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Like, and you have these affiliations and associations and families and experiences. And like, you don't even want those to define you, because it seems like you're less free. You're less autonomous if history has a say in who you are and who you're becoming. But I think, like you say, and what motivates so much of what you're writing here is I see compassion, right? Because there is a sense in which so much of postmodern humanity, especially in the West, when they ask the question, who am I, they don't have good answers. They
Right.
don't, they don't, and they don't know where to find them. And so, you know, postmodern theory and critical theory, these traditions come along, if you will, these new traditions, ironically, the tradition of critical theory, which rejects tradition. There's a way in which we say, no, the only way we're going to answer this question is if we discover it ourselves. The only way we're going to get an answer in which we're still free after we answer it is if we, you know, discover this self within us and find it. And I think that's a, again, I think that's, but at the same time, I think it's a compassionate question. It's a situation in which many of these postmodernists asked the right question, who am I? And they gave the worst possible answer. And so now what do we do? How do we rethink this? How can we, you know, start over and ask this question in a way that doesn't lead us to subjectivism and relativism and postmodernism? Because the question's still there. Who am I? Right?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, and I want us to get to the discussion about the church. But as you were studying this, did you find that there's the who is answering the question well, right? And why is this notion of the therapeutic making it harder to
Oh,
ask and answer the question at all?
yeah. Well, I probably should have reversed the order that I'm doing this, but let me explain why I think the therapeutic mindset is so significant, and why it leads one to discovering the self. And there's no freedom in that. You're just discovering the self. It just emerges somehow within me. I was steeped in Reef and Charles Taylor, and well, lots of others, Carl Truman, and I had read pretty much all of Freud. And one of the things I read was Alistair MacIntyre. I actually read his After Virtue, gosh, in the 80s, and didn't really get much out of it at the time. So I reread it, and because I had seen so many references back to it in the discussions about the therapeutic worldview, and I started realizing, oh, this is profound. Not just that he had profound insights, but that if you are given over to this therapeutic worldview, it's like it's like you're a different kind of being. Because it rests primarily on emotivism, which I came to understand better. It re relates back to the positivists, A.J. Ayer, and those kind of folks. The idea behind emotivism is that you evaluate morality, truth, claims, movements in society, and so on. You evaluate all of that on the basis of how it makes you feel. And when I first kind of went back to Alistair MacIntyre, I kind of went, ah, it just sounds, I mean, who would do that? But I'm seeing that no, that is actually what's going on. You are how you first feel about something actually does dictate whether you believe something to be right or wrong, or whether or not you believe something to be true or false, how I feel about it. So you don't use any kind of external measure, like some hierarchy of virtue and vice as you understand it. This is very significant. And I think how I came to understand how thoroughgoing, how completely of a mind change this is for somebody who's given over to the therapeutic, is the idea that they still sort of speak the language of logos, and so they can still talk to you and argue with you all day long about how wrong you are about your point of view about some social issue, but they're just using it manipulatively. They aren't actually subscribing to a logos or an external set of values. They just know you are. And it's all fair game in their view, because it all comes down to feelings. I mean, it's really not overstating it to say that all of their thought process is based on that. They trust their feelings, their emotional reaction to something, more than they do, a fair logical analysis of it.
So we're talking, you mentioned logos and logical analysis, but I could hear someone say, well, Bert, we still have feelings. They're going to happen. Is the alternative, how do we interpret the use of feelings? What are feelings? Are they revelatory of who we are, of identity, in some ways, or are they all suspect, right? Do we need to go full stoic, if you will, which of course is a
No.
simplification of the stoicism. So I wonder, in doing this, on the one hand, I see, and again, I would put this question to MacIntyre as well, is, look, I understand not wanting to base everything on emotions, right? This is going to be disastrous. I would eat even more, right? If I did that, it'd be unhealthy. But what is the status of emotions, since we can't avoid them? Right. Does that make sense? Like, where, what, how do we, what's the alternative view of emotions that doesn't take us down this postmodern road?
Okay, well, it would life would be dull without emotional re
Yeah,
responses.
right, yeah.
You'd say I love you to your wife, and she'd go, so
That's
I mean
logical. Thank you. Thank you.
yeah, that's very logical. That's because I'm pretty and nice, I guess.
Yeah.
No, of course, you don't want a life that has no emotional content. But the way I look at it is, and we all shouldn't be walking computers analyzing everything. But in the virtues, and you can find different ways of expressing virtues, but look to the Bible, for example. It talks about self-control as being among the very more important virtues. Well, what does that mean? It means self-control of your emotions. You don't let your emotions get the better of you. I would say it this way: your emotions work for you; you don't work for them. And so you and I see this all the time with people who just they lose their minds over because they've been provoked and they think that it's part of their value system for some reason that because they were provoked, they're justified in losing their minds in violence or whatever. And they're not. That's an occasion for self-control. You don't lash out in anger just because something happened that you don't like. So that, I mean, that's the way I would approach it. But when I first read McIntyre and so on, I thought, well, of course we have these emotions. We're not robots, but in the therapeutic worldview, I think what happens is that you become so given over to your emotions, the idea of self-control, it just isn't even on the radar screen.
It becomes self, it's the word, just kind of self-liberation, right? Instead
Yeah,
that,
it's
well,
ultimate liberation, sure.
yeah, that my impulses can only be good. I mean, that's kind of, what's funny is even Freud realizes that's disastrous, right? Freud is even going to come to the point of like, look, because Freud, of course, is an atheist, and he sees that we have these desires, we have these emotions, we want to realize our desires. But the superego is going to impose itself on the id, our desires, and it's going to make us unhappy, but we're just going to have to deal with it. Our ego is going to have to navigate this world of make your general unhappiness just more tolerable. It's this really dark vision of Freud, essentially that the whole world conspires against your happiness, and that you just need to deal with it, because Freud, at least in his mind, is going to admit, like, look, if we just indulge everything we ever wanted, civilization will not work. But realize we have to have these remissions, these releases, these moments of escape from it. And of course, later on, some of his students and progeny, they're going to take it farther and be like, no, you don't, like, just free yourself from the superego entirely. Free yourself from all tradition, from all contextual restraints, from all these teachings, from religion especially, because all those things are trying to control you, your id, your desires, your emotions, that's everything. And
Right. Well,
so, yeah.
that's the Marcuse and company. That's where the thought process is that, yeah, the superego, that's just the manifestation of authoritarianism in your life.
Yeah. You're a slave to your passions, right? This is what the classical Christian world saw, long before Freud. And what do we do with it? And that gets us to this next piece. So you don't talk about the church in the book, at least I didn't notice it. But you and I have brought this up just in private about how this therapeutic, for lack of a better word, worldview or an imagination, this disposition seems to have made its way into the church, especially among Protestants, but I don't think they're the only ones guilty of this. But how, and I have my own thoughts here. How do you see this playing out in the life of the church as you've experienced it? And I say the church, I mean it in a very broad sense, that Christianity doesn't seem to be resisting that, especially in America, does not seem to be resisting this postmodern therapeutic mindset very well, if at all. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. And what how have you seen it show up?
Well, in the going back to let's say the summer of Floyd and the pandemic and all of the thought control and all of that that was going on over the last 6 or so years, where critical theories, including critical race theory, and forms of what you can now openly say are basically Marxist of thought are were sort of hitting the church, and the church just didn't know what to do about it because the church was unprepared. And it was unprepared. I read your article on intellectual discipleship that from last April, and also I read carefully the article on Bashan and Alberta that you referred me to. And those are fair indictments of the church that they're that we have not been prepared. And I don't want to just lay this at the feet of pastors. I mean, it's true of all of us. It is true of me. In fact, I look back on, years and years of membership in a church, and why wasn't I more on the ball with this? Because it caught me off guard, and it caught the church leadership off guard. Let me give you a, you're familiar with Carl Truman, I suppose. So he's written so much in the last several years and has really been on the ball with this, and has written specifically about the therapeutic worldview. But he wrote an article in November of 2020. So think about what was going on then, where I don't know, 9 months or so into the pandemic. We've had the riots all summer, and it's easy at this distance to kind of forget how awful it was back then. So this is when he's writing this. He writes an article in for First Things, and he's talking about the therapeutic worldview. Now, when I read it, I wasn't nearly. I mean, I hadn't even done my 2023 book yet. I was just starting to learn about Reef and so on. But he was really on the ball, and he was talking about how the churches were sort of backfooted by all this. And he wrote this article about psychology and how we needed to understand it. And here's his closing words: "The needs of this hour are not so much that of explaining the church to the world. First, we need to explain the world to the church." And I thought, that's it. That's it. I had an experience where I'm hearing a sermon that is critical race theory through and through. I mean, I understood what it was. That's what it was. So no question about it. And when I say something about it, the answer is, "Oh, that's not critical race theory." So my response is, "Well, okay, how does it differ then?" Silence. And the way it differs is, we just don't want to, Christians don't want to hear that phrase because that scares them. They don't like that. They don't like the label. But the thing underneath it, I guess that's okay because it sounds like it's the nice thing.
That actually gets to a part of, so I reviewed Megan Basham's A Shepherd's for Sale, and then Tim Alberta's, was it The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory? Is that what it's called? Something like that. Anyways, they're books that came out relatively close to each other to compare how pastors are responding to the Trump era. And what you just said was I think really important, that we need to explain the world to the church because the church doesn't understand it anymore, or is so enmeshed in it that it doesn't even know when it's different, right? And in a way, the church has forgotten who it is, right? It's failing to ask the question of, I don't know if self is the right word, but it's forgotten who it was, instead just became a membership club, right? Where even the Ciceronian Society is a membership club, but we don't have an orthodoxy, right? In the way that a church has to. And so it's so easy for the church to unintentionally just sleepwalk into ways of thinking that are diametrically opposed to the Bible and the church tradition. And critical theory is a great example. And one of the ways it finds its way in is via a genuinely, I think, good impulse, right? Which is love your neighbor.
Sure.
And what does that mean in the midst of a postmodern world? Well, the problem is that in a postmodern world, love your neighbor means love everyone no matter what, okay, but it also means don't confront them about their sin,
right.
Don't critique, you know, don't say that some are better than others in this or that. It's kind of a radical egalitarianism and relativism, right? That's what it has become, is that love your neighbor is basically everyone is good. It's a denial of original sin. It goes back to Rousseau, where it ends up being not loving, but it's hard to remind people of that. Because we don't want to be, I mean, I don't want to be my sin to be pointed out all the time, right? It's not comfortable.
Right.
But it also is a loving thing to do, right? If someone says, Josh, what you're doing is genuinely hurting not just other people, but yourself, you know, that's not unloving. It is a deep and profound way of loving someone.
Well, the idea of being salt and light to the world.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you do you, and I've got nothing to say about it.
Yeah.
If you care about somebody, you know, and they're about to drive off a cliff, you might say, "Hey, let's not drive off a cliff, okay?"
Yeah.
That's so you know that's that. But I became convinced that we keep saying postmodernism. That postmodernism collection of ideologies. The therapeutic worldview is also its own sort of ideology, but because it is the subconscious, it is psychology, it sort of overlays on all of the principles of postmodernism, the more propositional kinds of things. So the therapeutic worldview combined with the underlying philosophies that are prevalent now, well, I'll call all of that postmodernism. I'm convinced that the shift from paganism to the Christian era is not more profound than the shift from the Christian era to the postmodern. So it's that much of a cataclysmic shift. Well, if we've been in the postmodern era now for, I don't know, 100, 120 years or whatever it is, and we're not aware of it, you know, we need to be. You know, suppose instead of the postmodern era, we had reverted back to pagan times. How would we not? Well, first of all, we'd recognize it more easily, I suppose, because we have historical memory. But it would be so obviously fundamentally different across society to the Christian era that we'd take notice and we'd pay attention and we'd do something about it and we'd hopefully teach the truth. And because church leaderships tend not to understand how profound the shift is into postmodernism. They tend to be asleep at the wheel. And I took your intellectual discipleship thing, and I went through, and you made some great points, and so I elaborate on them. And I just kind of thinking about this morning, I came up with 8 different items about how we got where we are.
Ooh, go ahead, go for it.
Okay.
8 different items. All right, number one.
One of them, you mentioned anti-intellectualism.
Okay.
So I don't have a lot to add to that. I think it's owing to a desire for, you know, we want to be indwelled by the Holy Spirit. We don't need all of that fancy theology. Right. It kind of gets in the way. You touched on this, the idea that there's a division. This is number two, division between philosophy and theology. Well, I think that's huge because to my mind, theology was a part of philosophy all the way up until about the beginning of the postmodern era. In fact, it's occurred to me that you get to William James, he's a philosopher for sure, and is talking about theological subjects right around the turn of the 20th century, especially in Will to Believe. And after that, his fellow pragmatists like John Dewey, and really almost all of the philosophers that come after him are secular philosophers. They presuppose naturalism. And it's like theology has kind of gone off into, it's not that there's not some great theologians, there are, but they all go off into their own little cul-de-sac over here. That's the church world, and that's how it divides up. And in secular society, you're not getting the real picture of reality because it's kind of cropped at the, you know, there's no supernatural reality. There's no need to have a discussion of an afterlife. There's no need to discuss this human need for sacrifice and the idea that there can be redemption and that the fact that you need to be redeemed because we're all Rousseau now. So all of that is...
Well, I would even take it just to kind of, you know, yeah, I think, you know, with William James, John Dewey, you know, it really becomes pronounced there. I mean, even John Stuart Mill, and earlier than that, right, Hegel, Marx, Kant, et cetera. But you could even go back to Descartes and Hobbes, right,
yeah.
Where there is a sense in which the divorce begins years before this.
Sure.
But it took a while to just to fully cement itself.
Yeah.
And the educated elite, you know, the imagination. And eventually, of course, it has an impact on the training of pastors and clergy generally, especially starting in the 19th century. You know, how many clergy today take classes in philosophy? There are certainly some. I think in terms of, I think the Catholic clergy, as well as Orthodox clergy, I think they're required to, depending on where they go. But Protestants... half the time, that's not it, right?
Well,
not
but
always the case.
It sure is necessary because that's how you get around to explaining the world to the church.
Yeah.
So number three, religion is not just interdicts; it's also remission, right? In terms, and there's a mystery element to religion. There has to be. I mean, this is how you that's how you resolve the paradoxes in religion, the unanswerable things. How do you have freedom when you also have constraint? All of these things. How do you have free will when you also have predestination? Working through all of these things requires some acceptance of a mystery beyond our understanding. What I think has happened is instead of giving us the mystery, we're given emotion instead, and the emotion stands in for that source of mystery. And that feeds right into the therapeutic worldview.
I might also add that there's the anti-intellectualism you mentioned earlier, but it's where their critique is right, where their critique is at times that the highfalutin educated folk, they don't have faith. Well, you know what? They're right sometimes. That's exactly what's going on, right? I won't believe it unless the data tells me, unless you can prove it without a shadow of a doubt with all this empirical evidence. Now, I'm not dissing empirical evidence, but I do think there is a sense in which, you know, sometimes intellectuals earn the animosity that they get, right? Especially when they dismiss things like faith and mystery, because that becomes a danger unto itself.
Right. It's just, it betrays a lack of understanding of what faith even is.
Right,
And
right,
I don't
right.
mean faith is believing stuff that, you know, is unbelievable because there's no empirical evidence. That's not what faith is. And I keep watching my Substacks because I'm going to write more on that.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Number four, I would say a lack of diligence in figuring out what the secular philosophers have been up to. And that's kind of what we've been talking about. Number five, because we and the church leadership have not been paying attention to the direction of travel of secular philosophy, I think it has led us, we're caught off guard by the anti-life spirit of negation, I'm going to call it, that is a part of all of this postmodern philosophy, the sum of all of it combined with the therapeutic worldview. And that's sort of another way of saying we haven't been paying close enough attention, but this is sort of point to where it leads to, because the postmodern philosophy is not just anti-God, as if that weren't enough, but it's also really taking us down. I'm convinced.
Yeah, and I would it helps make sense of, you know, how could a civilization that supposedly is more free, more autonomous, be so enthusiastic about abortion and euthanasia? You know, you just look at
Exactly.
Canada, for example. It's so rampant, right?
Right.
Is a sense in which we have slept, we're sleep, we think we're free, but we're just moving toward the abolition of man, right? In C.S. Lewis's words.
Exactly. Let's see, where was I? Number six. I think that so we've had this attitude that we need to not get political in our churches. Well, I think that's right up to a point. There's back when left versus right was just really a question of, well, how socialist are we going to get, how fast? Well, you could say, yeah, let's keep that out of the church. But I think we're conflating culture and politics by saying, well, let's not have any politics. Well, hang on a second. I'm not even sure left and right are really valid anymore. I mean, we've got some things going on that are culturally just poisonous. And if we're not in the churches saying that and saying exactly why it's poisonous, instead of saying why, let's say, critical race theory is poisonous, we say why it's the way to be nice. We're not seeing it for what it is, and we're staying away from what are really poisonous cultural issues because it's quote politics unquote.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. There's an overreaction, right? Because on the one hand, and this is what Tim Alberta, I think, misses in his book as well, and Megan Basham, by the way. On the one hand, you have someone like Tim Alberta, who, in my view, was kind of moving the church away from politics altogether. And I'm sympathetic to saying, get out of the partisan stuff, right? If someone, I think we need to pray for our leaders. I think that's actually quite, objectively biblical. I think it's very clear in the Bible that, as a church, no matter who the president is, no matter who's in control of Congress, the Supreme Court, et cetera, we are called to pray for those people. But, endorsing candidates would be one thing. On the other hand, just completely ignoring it sounds very dangerous to me. It leaves open other disciplers, right? If you're not going to shepherd your people, who someone's going to, right? Someone is going to be responsible for the political and moral and social formation of your flock, pastor. Is it going to be you? Is it going to be you and your diocese? Is it going to be you and your elders? Or is it going to be YouTube and whatever the loudest voice is? And I think there is a danger there, right? I'm not advocating for churches to move in a partisan direction, but I think you're right, Bert, that we need to say, like, this is who we are as a congregation, as a denomination, as what we believe. And we're going to draw a line in the sand. Abortion is not okay. Euthanasia is not okay. You can say that's political, but I don't care. It is the truth. And so I think there's an element of, you're right, there's a fear, in part because, going back to intellectual discipleship, pastors are not prepared to think about these questions that well. Right.
And if you don't speak to it at all, you're backhandedly validating the n maybe not a particular candidate or a particular position even, but you're validating the notion that we're just that all of this is neutral and how you vote is none of my business, and none of this really matters to your life as a Christian because for whatever reason, we're all going to die and go to heaven anyway, so who cares? Okay, number seven is I was going to say the therapeutic mindset. As I said, in my way of thinking about it, sort of superimposes on the philosophical postmodernism. But the therapeutic mindset itself softens intellectual formation. So you start out with an insufficient intellectual formation. The more you go to emotion and these the songs that are intended to evoke emotion in worship service, and that's taking the place of the mystery and charisma of religion, it's also softening the ability to engage in intellectual formation. And that really makes us vulnerable to throwing over the whole Christian project because at some point it'll seem like it no longer makes sense. It's eclipsed by the intellectual rigor that you can still see going on out there in secular philosophy, which presupposes naturalism.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, there, I mean, the therapeutic worldview also it influences or provokes or inspires a Christianity that, or you know, quote unquote Christianity that costs you nothing, right? It is a Christianity that makes you feel good, right? It's a Christianity that feels more like a support group than anything else. Well, how do you? It's hard, if not impossible, to learn in that environment, to be stretched, to be challenged, to grow, right? Why even have confession? What have I done wrong? I mean, the ultimate, I've never seen anyone actually do this, but I can imagine this needs to be in a short story of some kind where essentially the therapeutic pastor leads the congregation in a confession of everyone else's sins, right? You know, it just becomes a parody where it, I mean, I am at a, you know, on the other hand, there's the other side of this too, where you get to a point in the service, at least in our liturgy in Anglicanism, we'll get to a point where, you know, there's a moment of silence to confess your sins to Almighty God before we confess our sins collectively. And I always joke with the priest. I said, you know, one of these days I'm going to come to confession. I'm just going to say, hold my beer. And then we're just going to, there's going to be a lot to say. But that's not a therapeutic worldview, right? It's that, you know, I'm so sorry that my government is unjust, right? That's not, you know, you're confessing someone else's sins. You can't be absolved for someone else's sins either, right? And so I think there's a lot to be said about that, Bert. I think that therapeutic worldview also hinders the intellectual side of Christianity as well, because if church is simply another support group, if it's simply therapy, why would it be a place of learning? Because learning is stressful. Learning is not always fun. Learning means you're going to have to think hard, and you may have to be wrong and admit it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to deal with your syndromes, not your sin.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
Okay. Number eight. To me, I have a criticism. I'm not sure what to do about this. I'm not sure specifically how to say this should be different.
Okay.
But very much a consumer-oriented model for doing church, and this bothers me because it gets directly in the way of, now you used this phrase and I really liked it, so I'm stealing it. You talked about making, instead of making bigger churches, make bigger Christians. And I think that's exactly right, because for one thing, I don't go to church in order to be affirmed in everything I do.
Right.
I go there to contemplate my Maker and to figure out how I need to get my life in the right direction and to express worship. If I'm just going there and participating in programs and the church is getting bigger and yay, the church is doing so well, and oh, our pastor's really stepping up in the, you know, in the standings, he's almost a celebrity pastor. If that's the way I'm thinking about church, then we're just doing it totally wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that quote of bigger Christians, by the way, comes from Dallas Willard's book, The Divine Conspiracy, which is, I cannot recommend highly enough for those of you listening. If you've never read that, it's a challenging book. It's a great example, actually, of the combination of philosophy and theology, which Dallas Willard, I think, uniquely in our particular moment, is of course, he passed away several years ago, but his he married them very well. He is a philosopher and a theologian, and he put them together in ways that are profound. And that notion of getting to bigger Christians, a primarily transaction market consumer driven church can't get there, because I'm not against free markets, but in order for the market to work, you know, people demand something that the market supplies, whether that demand is morally upright or the supply is morally upright is irrelevant. It's that the market is going to supply what is being demanded, ideally, right? And then prices will tell you different things. So I'm not getting into an economics lesson, but that's not the way the church is meant to work. I don't think that's controversial, in the sense that we are called to make disciples of all nations, as the Bible says. That is not going to be in demand. It is not going to be the most popular thing on the market, if you will. There's not a giant market to be like, hey, can you please, you know, I mean, think about what Christianity calls us to do. It calls us, it calls us to come and die to self, take up your cross and follow me.
Right.
Offer your bodies as living sacrifices. It's not a path for the people who just want to feel good and have an easy life. That's ridiculous. And so I think there is a sense in which I brought this up in that article, is that, you know, intellectual discipleship is only, I didn't say it like this, but intellectual discipleship, whatever it looks like in your given church, is only going to emerge if the your ecclesiological premise is that this congregation, this church, these worship services are not about you. They're not about your feelings. They are about the worship of the one true, holy, only God. And that we want to know him and his creation more, and therefore we are willing to learn at the cost of our time, our energy, and at times our feelings, right? I think there's the part where the anti-intellectualism, you know, your number one and your number eight come full circle, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of where we're at.
That's well said.
Yeah. Well, Bert, I think we've exhausted this topic, and we could talk forever about it. We just exhausted me because I have to go shovel 3 feet of snow off my driveway. Actually, it's not 3 feet right now. It's closer to 6 inches, but it has been 3 feet over the last week. So I won't even start. All you people in the South complaining about your 5 inches
yeah,
of snow.
I was going to say, I'm looking outside and you know, it's a sunny day. There's no snow on the ground.
Come on. Whatever. All right. Well, Bert, let me ask you one last question. Are you writing another book? What's next for you?
That's a good question. No, I'm not currently engaged. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts, directions I'd like to go. I've been trying to write more meaningfully on my Substacks that come out every week.
Yeah.
That keeps me busy. I write letters to my whole family and a bunch of other people every so often. But at the end of every year, I make a book out of it.
Oh, wow.
So
Okay.
I guess you could call that a book.
Yeah. All right. The collected works of Albert Norton. That's
Something
only
like that.
Someday. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to seeing you at our conference in Omaha.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. The 2026 conference will be at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. I don't quite know when this will be published, but registration will close on or around March 1st. We'll also be having our first ever fall symposium in Holland, Michigan in October of this year. Be sure to keep an eye out for more information very soon. Please rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.